Welcome everybody to the Roxborough House Roundtables. This is a feature of the All Inspector Center where we get together with students, with faculty and staff to discuss the important issues of the day. Today is a very special roundtable. We are discussing the crisis in the Ukraine and we have a very special panel, which I'd like to introduce before handing it off to our moderator. We have Dr. Raju Parakel, who's Associate Professor of International Relations. We have Dr. Tom Schran, Associate Dean for General Education and Professor of History. We have our special guest, Dr. Alexander Kovasov, who's an Adjunct Professor of Global Politics, who was born in the former Soviet Union, and he closely follows developments in contemporary Russia and has definitely a particular focus on the events that are going on today. And of course, Dr. Samuel Weeks, who's Assistant Professor of Anthropology, who will serve as our moderator today. Dr. Weeks.
Hi, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here with you all today. Hopefully soon we'll be able to do this in person. There's a bit of a...
Everybody, please go on mute. Everybody mute.
Great. I'll start again. So it's a pleasure to be here with you all today, even if it is in the event of Europe's most active period of warfare since World War II. It's been a whirlwind last 2 weeks, during which Russia has not only recognized the independence of two Ukrainian provinces taken over by separatists in 2014, but has also launched a three-front invasion of Ukraine proper, a sovereign country with which Russia enjoys deep and long-standing social, cultural, economic, and religious ties. Concurrently, we have seen Ukrainian service personnel and civilian volunteers mount an impressive defense of their homeland, though not without sustaining casualties that now most likely number in the thousands. Recent days has shown us the extent of the hostilities and bloodshed. In response to encountering heavier than expected resistance, Russian forces have stepped up their shelling of Ukraine's cities, going so far as to threaten civilian areas and the country's nuclear facilities. In response, millions of refugees have fled to countries to Ukraine's west, including Poland, Hungary, Czech Republic, and Moldova. Last but not least, has been an unprecedented response from Western countries led by the US, the NATO military alliance, and the European Union. Due to this coordinated action, Russia's government and businesses have been shut out of international payment systems, as well as their foreign reserves held in US dollars. While Western corporations from IKEA to McDonald's have pulled out completely from the Russian market. All of these measures and sanctions have caused the Russian ruble to lose more than 50% of its value in international currency markets since the start of the invasion. And on that note, I would like to turn the floor over to Dr. Kovasov. And I have a question maybe to get us started here. And I'm, like many other commentators, I'm very interested in learning more about the tactics or the logic behind what Putin and other state elites are doing. And I'm thinking of two kind of responses here. On the one hand, we've seen like significant military interventions in Chechnya and Georgia. But on the other hand, in recent years, Putin has really excelled in more atraditional forms of warfare like trolling, cyber attacks, bluffing, threats, proxy wars. So why do you think that there's been this reversion to like brute military strength at the expense of a set of tactics that Putin has used to a good deal of success?
So thank you for the introduction, both Evan and Sam, I appreciate it. There are many ways to answer this question. And I guess one way to start thinking about it is more along the lines of why now? Why not a year ago? Why not in the summer? Why not last summer? Why wait till the winter? Why not a year from now in general? What stands in the way of making that decision later? I don't know the answer to that. frankly. But I do know that Russia historically likes to start offensives following the New Year's. As you remember, the 2014 Olympics coincided with the invasion of and then annexation of Crimea, which led to the separatist conflict as well in eastern Ukraine, in the two regions in question that you mentioned. And it was really an ongoing conflict, standoff, if you will, with Russia meddling in Ukrainian affairs and supporting the separatist regions and obviously occupying Crimea. And this led to what we're looking at today, which is an all-out war of one sovereign state against another. Of course, in Russia, as Putin regularly refers to it, it's a special operation. It's not an actual conflict that involves two states. It's just a benign intervention on behalf of a state that sees things more clearly against a state that perhaps doesn't in the mind of Putin and his inner circle. And thinking about Putin and his inner circle is very important. Understanding who these people are is essential to understanding why Russia is behaving this way. In fact, Michael McFaul, former ambassador to Russia, recently interviewed and also has written a number of pieces in Russian. In 2020, he wrote an article called, and I'm actually going to share the references for this article, the reference for this and other pieces in just a little bit in the chat, but he stated in that article, and I agree with him, that the reason Russia is behaving the way it is behaving today in 2020, and we can make a very easy connection to 2022, is because of the choices that are made by the very highest ranked officials, including Putin himself. And should Putin have a different perception, he would behave differently. Or should there be another leader, that leader does not necessarily have to be doing what Putin is doing today. Choices could be different. So having said that, in order for us to understand why Russia is doing what it is doing today, the way it is doing, we really need to look back in history as far as 30 years ago, but also really understand Russia's history as far as 300 to 400 years back, looking back to the reign of Catherine the Great, which I'll reference in a bit if time allows. But in any case, why is this all-out warfare in Ukraine versus why not use trolling? Why not use social media? Why not use media propaganda in general and so on and so forth in Ukraine, like it has been globally and like it was in the United States and continues to be in the United States today following the 2016 election interference here? The answer is simple. All that has been tried in Ukraine for the last 20 years. Ukraine has lived through that before the US even thought about it or experienced it. Ukraine has been under constant attack of that kind from Russia in all possible ways imaginable. In fact, I would go as far as to say, this is going to be somewhat controversial, but I'll say Ukraine was the testing ground for many of the tools, cyber tools, that Russia is using in the world today. It's also, in a way, a culmination of growing Russian confidence in its own military power, which since Putin took over in 1999, and then, of course, there was a referendum there that approved him in 2000 as the president for the first time, not a stand-in for Yeltsin. We know that ever since, Russia has been ascendant in every possible way when it comes to military. It's been regaining its military strength. It's been adopting new technologies. It's been integrating cyber technologies into its arsenal, and it's been testing those things out. It's tested it in Ukraine in 2004 during the Orange Revolution. It later tested it in Georgia and also military power in Georgia in 2008. It tested it in Ukraine again, as you know, in 2014 with the invasion of Crimea. And it has been an ongoing and an ever-growing campaign to employ all of these tools. Why did it culminate in warfare? Maybe because other channels have been tested out and exhausted, or maybe because of other factors that I think we'll need to understand if we look back at history the way I'd like us to in just a few moments. A follow-up from Sam, you're muted, or anybody else, I guess, okay. In the chat.
Alec, let me ask you something I don't have an understanding of this, and I think many of my students don't as well. What does he want? That's just getting really as fundamental as we can. What does he want?
Yeah. So again, there are multiple ways to answer this question. One of them, number one, in my case, would be, I have no idea. Nobody does except for him and maybe his closest consultants like Peskov, who is essentially living in his guest house, right? Or Lavrov, the foreign minister, or maybe a handful of other people who are in that inner circle, who are not necessarily government officials, but who are his cronies dating back to late 80s, early 90s, and really who have been with him along his side and accumulated power, influence, and capital as he has been in power for the last 20 some years. So one way to say is, I don't know, and only he knows. That's one way to say it or answer this question. But to answer it in other ways, I can say that in quite very simple terms, all he wants is more power and more influence. In fact, power is the only language, in my opinion, Putin understands. He doesn't understand, I don't think he even cares as much about money as he cares about power. And that power comes in many different ways, but it is essentially the ability to either through leadership or through influence, coercion, if you will, to get what he wants. And there's never enough of it, in my mind, in his mind. That's assuming that he is somewhat normal, which obviously we all know that he's not. I mean, I'll ask a blunt question. Who doesn't want more power, more ability to get what they want out of things, even if they're pursuing benign goals? Everybody does. But in his case, that power is intended for two reasons in the end, which becomes just one reason. Reason number two, it's to increase Russia's influence, Russia's position in the world in every possible way. That's reason number two, because number one is really to do that himself. And I guess this is an appropriate moment to use this quote, and I really like it. Ludwig XIV, French monarch, who was a contemporary of Catherine the Great, their time overlapped there before she died in 1796. He said, as you know, famously, l'état, c'est moi, or I am the state, or the state is me, or however you want to translate it. Well, if there ever was a leader in Russia following Catherine the Great, it is Putin. In fact, I would go as far as to say that he's probably accumulated more influence and power than anybody, including Catherine the Great, who has reigned for 34 years, Stalin for some 28 years, Putin now for 20 some years, roughly 22 years, right? So he's getting there. And based on the course of things, unless something happens that reverses this course or breaks it abruptly, he's going to stay in power for quite some time. And so compared to anybody else in power in Russia or the former Soviet Union, no one has accumulated this much absolute power as he has. And it comes through the control of the economy, of the political institutions, of the educational institutions, obviously of the military, and above all, the media, which, as you all know, has been in the news for quite some time. Now, if you report anything, even if you're a legitimate media outlet in Russia, that is other than what is provided by the government authority, you're subject to a sentence of up to 15 years, regardless of whether or not you are a Russian citizen. You will go to prison. And what happens next is not going to be discussed here, but that is the reality. And I believe today that law was rubber stamped by the Russian parliament. That institution that I just mentioned was molded into doing what the absolute leader of Russia, Putin, wants it to do. And this is the case with a number of other laws that have passed in the last couple of decades that we can talk about. But he wants to stay in power. He wants to stay in power because he wants to continue increasing his own power. He wants to stay in power because if he doesn't, the only other option is to start losing power. And if that is the case, the only end to that course is his full demise. destruction. He's going to either be tried, or he's either going to be killed by either someone who is stronger than him in Russia, or maybe by the very people that are currently voting for him and support the course of action that Russia has taken. I don't want to say that all Russians do, but I do want to say that many do. And it is, again, not just the result of their own choices, but the result of the kind of brainwashing that has affected the Russian society over the last 20 years as part of the control of the media that Kremlin, aka Putin, exercise over the population and the society at large. And this spills outside of Russia into the neighboring countries, into countries that support Russia, and also into countries that oppose Russia, like the United States. I mean, do I need to talk about the liking that the former president of the United States has for Mr. Putin and the way he continually defends him? And there's a really large segment of political clout here in the United States that tends to support Putin and the course of action that he has taken. It's amazing to me that when you turn on certain channels, you hear things that are in complete opposites to the reality of what's happening on the ground. But nevertheless, I want to say that it is the result of that propaganda spilling over, but also that hybrid warfare, and the portion of course, is cyber warfare that Russia has been conducting to be able to affect people's minds and hearts around the world.
Hey, Alex, I just want to take that point that you said about what does, you know, in response to Evan's question of what does Putin want? And you said it's power and more power. And I completely agree with you. And that leads me to ask and think about and analyze this question of, okay, what's the immediate end game here for Putin in terms of, okay, let's say he gets Ukraine, effective control, complete control over Kyiv, everything. Is that going to satisfy him? If yes, for how long? So would like to hear your thoughts on that.
My thoughts, of course, and yeah. I'll be happy to provide them. But if anybody...
I do have some thoughts, but I want to hear.
I'll be happy.
You're the person. Yeah, go ahead.
Of course. So the end game for him, and I'm going to quote Catherine the Great now, the only way for me to defend my borders is to extend them. The end game for him is to have, in an ideal world, authoritarian dictators that are in agreement with his behavior and are willing to do what he wants them to do. Example, case in point, Belarus or Belarusia, whatever you want to call it, or Kazakhstan for that matter, right? Or Uzbekistan. Authoritarian dictators that you don't have to worry about, because they're going to do what they do and they'll be happy with it as long as they keep what they have. And as long as Putin supports them, they probably will. Again, case in point, Belarus, right? There's absolutely no doubt about that. And that is the case. But then when there are countries that have democratic tendencies, that are democratic, that wants to be more democratic, that wants to find the kind of stability that democracy brings with it, and of course, all the fruits of any kind of economic institutions that at their nexus are really good with democratic institutions, let's call it market economy. So anytime you have a country that is successful, that you can influence, that will ultimately result in undermining that country's success in any way, he's going to do that. And he's done that even in stable countries all across Europe. Any politician who is populist, who is against status quo, who exhibits radical or right-wing tendencies that reflects the values that Putin holds himself, or the values opposite to those of status quo, which reflect the democratic institutions, he is going to support. Russia has funded campaigns of people like Marine Le Pen in France. He's done that in all across Europe. He's done it in Hungary. He's done it in Czech Republic, in Serbia. In Serbia, I don't know if you know this or not, there was a meeting in support or a protest in support of Putin. And guess what they all wore? The Z emblems on their uniforms, on their chests, or they carried flags with the Z that is now painted on Russian vehicles that are pouring into Ukraine, right? Or the V, or the Z, or the W, or all of the above, or the one in the square, you name it. But anyways, it's become a symbol, which I think is the result of the extent to which Russia has been able to control people's minds and sell the version of reality that it wants people to ingest. And we can talk about that when we talk about Putinism. And I would really like to talk about Putinism at some point today. But I will say that Putin's end goal is to either have a fully obedient government in Ukraine, which will never happen, or he will succeed if Ukraine is in perpetual state of instability. Call it guerrilla warfare, call it civil war, call it some sort of other protracted conflicts, as long as Ukraine is that and not stable, transitioning from one president to the other with regular elections that are not rigged in any way, and approaching a possibility of closer ties with the European Union, then he has succeeded.
Yeah, and I do think about this in the context of the expansion of the eastward expansion of NATO. And I'm wondering, because back in the day, all the other countries like, you know, Poland, Romania, Bulgaria, they all provided a buffer to Russia, to the Soviet Union. But now let's say Ukraine becomes part of Russia. There's no more Ukraine. It's a land territory, part of Russia. There's no buffer. So it makes a lot of sense in what you're saying is that, Putin does not want Ukraine to be part of Russia, but Putin wants a Ukraine that is almost like a puppet state of Russia so that it won't come closer to NATO or to the EU.
He doesn't hide this intent.
Yeah.
He says that he needs a government that is demilitarized,
exactly,
denazified, something we really do need to talk about here as well, and obedience to the Russian government, right? And then let it be, let it live there. And when it needs our help, will come to it. And again, he would love to have a second Belarusia or Belarus in the name of Ukraine there. He would absolutely love it. And if you're wondering what life would be like for Poland, for, I don't know, countries that border Ukraine, Moldova, and so on and so forth, if you wonder what life is going to be like for them living next to a puppet government, just look north and look at Belarus and look at what's happening there and its Western neighbors. And that is what life is going to be like. And that's in the best case scenario. That's assuming that there's some sort of best case scenario for Putin, assuming that there's some sort of stability achieved there. And he would absolutely love that. And if you think Moldova is next, I would say, yeah. If Ukraine is success, there's a puppet government there. Hands down, former Soviet state, Moldova is next. Yeah. Do we think that he might go as far as Estonia, Lithuania, and Latvia? That's going to be really hard to do because they're in the NATO. But there has been talk about demilitarizing them as well. And there will be talk about denazifying them as well, I'm sure, or de-radicalizing them, or whatever you want to call it. Because whenever you want someone to be disliked, you put a label on them, call them Nazis. And that's what they've been doing really, really successfully, a blanket statement. And of course, Nazis are for LGBTQ, Nazis are for women's rights, Nazis are for everything that is against the values that Putin and Putinism hold and attemptedly try to disseminate and reinforce throughout society, or societies for that matter, or the world for that matter.
Sam, do you want to take over, or do you want to continue?
I think Tom has a question, and then maybe we go to the chat. There's a question from Karen Albert, but Tom, why don't you go ahead?
Sure. Alex, you promised maybe to say a little bit about Putinism, and I'd be interested to hear more about that. I've studied Russian history. I'm not in any sense expert on current Russian society or Putin's career.
You always start so modestly, Tom.
I'm just an interested observer with recent events. So I'd be interested to hear what your thoughts about one of the things I'm starting to think about this conflict in Putin's behavior is how much of it is inspired by a kind of Russian nationalism and this idea of a kind of a greater Russian state, and almost like Hitler's vision of unifying Germans, you know, in multiple countries under one, you know, one territory. Could we, is it possible to look at what Putin is doing in Ukraine as a strategy to, you know, get Donetsk and, you know, the those eastern, you know, ethnic Russian dominated areas, you know, within the Russian state? And then I think, like you're saying, make the rest of Ukraine a kind of rump state that has a puppet, you know, leadership. Do you think maybe that is as far as he's trying to get, that the invasion was, you know, a strategy to give himself a negotiating position to get that final outcome, which is to incorporate those eastern provinces and have a non-NATO allied, non-democratic government for the rest of Ukraine?
So that's a great question. And I do hope to get to talking about Putinism specifically, but very much a part of Putinism is an element that scholars have found as sort of a part of Russian culture, civilization, and psyche dating back centuries, and that is messianism. Being sort of the savior of the world, if you will. Right? Being that beacon, but more than that, being the force that transforms the planet in a better way. So it's always been on the mind of all rulers of Russia, all of the Romanovs, and all of the Soviet leaders. And some of them really genuinely did believe in the values, let's say, of Russia or later of the Soviet Union. And they really did think that those values can in fact change the world for the better. I mean, if you think about the Bolsheviks and then later the communists, think about Karl Marx for that matter. And what you realize is that, I mean, they really did have a well-meaning plan for trying to rescue humanity and make the world more egalitarian and sort of better for a common person. They did have that. And there were leaders in the Soviet Union, there were people in the government of the Soviet Union that have really thought about this and truly believed this idea and committed themselves to it. And there were some good things that came out of it. Soviet Union brought a lot of good things to many parts of the world. And we're not just talking about free oil to countries like Cuba, right? We're talking about educational institutions. We're talking about medical improvements or advancements. We're talking about scientific advancements. Right. Many a country around the world can thank the Soviet Union for having a nuclear plant, for example. So just, you know, now let's not open up that kind of worms. Do we believe in nuclear technology or not? That's a different conversation we can have. Maybe that one will get 80 people or more, Evan. But in any case, if you think about what Russia is trying to accomplish in an ultimate sort of outcome for Putin, it would be puppet governments in former Soviet states or authoritarian governments that are in full agreement with him without any opposition to him. Case in point, I've already named a couple. We can talk about more. But then you have China that seems to be aligned with Russia more than less and may in fact either help the situation in Ukraine or worsen it if it buys Russian oil and minerals and so on and so forth. We'll see what happens. But the point is that in an ideal world, Russia would be surrounded by states like that, states with puppet governments or states in turmoil, which Ukraine might become. And then from there, it can actually wage that hybrid warfare for countries that aren't unstable and countries that are democratic, countries that Putin sees as threatening to him. And one simple reason for why any democratic state would be threatening to Putin is simple. It's epitomous with what I just said. It's democracy. Right? It's that right to choose, to speak up, to associate, to be your own agent of socio-political and economic change. That doesn't sit or bode well with Putin and the system that he has created in the country, which is really intended for one purpose only, to maintain and increase his own power. That's Putinism, which has his name in the root of the word. But in any case, and then from there, he can wage warfare. He's already done that. His attempted and continued ongoing efforts to divide societies with democratic institutions are only going to increase. We're going to see more of what happened here in 2016 all around the world, and it's been happening. It's not like it stopped, it's ongoing. We're going to see more of that in countries like Hungary, like Czech Republic, like Slovakia, any country that closed its airspace to Russian flights first, you know, are going to be the target first, and then everybody else. He'll go as far as France, he'll go as far as Great Britain, he'll go as far as Spain and Italy. He's going to do all of that. Now, it's going to be easier with some of these countries because they're dependent on Russian energy. They're dependent on Russian natural gas. I don't know if I misread it. It was a headline a few days ago, but is a cubic meter of natural gas in Germany, is it costing something like thousands of dollars? I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's something insane, right? And I'm not sure how long that is going to go on before some of these countries are going to break and compromise. I don't know how much longer we can wait, especially considering that it's winter time, and that could be one of the reasons for why it happened in the winter. It's easier to control societies that are dependent on energy in the winter than it is in the summer. And so that's what I see as a future if there is success and no catastrophic outcome to this particular conflict. And catastrophic outcome is something we do need to think about. And of course, you know what I'm referring to. It's his threat. It's continued ongoing conversation about the use of nuclear weapons. Let's say they're not used anywhere else but Ukraine. The big question for the West is going to be, what are we going to do? Since we're not taking part in it now, turn on the news right now. We do not want to have World War III. We do not want to be sucked into this conflict. Considering that all of the humanitarian suffering that has occurred and is occurring right now, all across Ukraine, and that has not in any way changed the direction of Russia's action in Ukraine. If it culminates in a nuclear weapon, what will the West do then? That's a big question to ask. And I think there's only two choices that we're going to face, use one or not. I don't think there's going to be another way around it. And if the West doesn't use the nuclear weapon in response, then what are the alternatives there other than letting Putin continue to do what he does with that big stick in his hand? I mean, game theory is the way to sort of try to figure this out, right? But game theory rests on political theories that are commonplace across international relations, and game theory that essentially attempts to predict how states will behave under certain circumstances is well rested within realism. Putinism is not realism. And I don't think it's based on rational decision-making. I don't think it's based on logical outcomes and weighing of the costs and benefits of your actions. It's based more on opportunity. And I think this is in the best case if the main actor of this structure at the very top of it, called Putin, if he is in fact well. And if he is in fact well, then we can hope for opportunism to be the guiding principle of what's happening in Russia, which it has been all along. It saw an opportunity in having Trump elected, and it did everything it could to do that. For what cause, for what goal? Well, you saw what happened here for the next 4 years, what's happening still. And if you think this country, this society is not divided, you've been living in, I think, an alternate reality there. So this is what I think. And there's a lot more to it. And someone asked me, a friend of mine from Scotland asked me, as soon as Russia invaded, what's the worst thing that can happen? The worst thing that can happen is the US shooting back with a nuclear weapon. And then you know what it can lead to. And if we're looking at World War III with the use of nuclear weapons, then that's what we're looking at. I told him this all can end very quickly if that happens. And by this, I mean the world that we know. And this is very realistic. This is very serious. We have not come this close to a threat of the use of nuclear weapons by an absolute leader of a country that possesses one of the largest, if not the largest, arsenal of nuclear weapons that has consistently upgraded it. We've never been this close to a threat like that ever before. And because of the kind of absolute power accumulated by this one individual, and because of essentially no opposition to his ultimate decision-making. If there ever was anyone in history who can press that button as easily as he can, it is him. And we should be worried. I don't think nuclear conflict is off the table. And I also told my Scottish friend, his name is Geddes, I said, Geddes, the more isolated he becomes, the riskier is the situation. The more he's pushed by anything, sanctions, sale of weapons, death of Russian soldiers, attempts to wage hybrid warfare against Russia, the more he feels isolated and threatened, the more he will keep that case nearby.
I just wanted to ask a question from the audience here in the chat box. And if folks have questions, please put them in the chat box. Happy to run them by Dr. Klazov. This is from Karen Albert. And it goes back to your timing question. So again, in winter, people need Russian natural gas to heat their houses, to run their factories, that kind of thing. And it's an interesting question. Why do you think Putin is doing this now and not when Trump was president?
He didn't need to do it when Trump was president. Why would he do it at a time when he had a friendly person in the White House? Now, we haven't gotten to the bottom. I'm sorry, I'm going to get into this. We haven't gotten to the bottom of what really took place between Putin and Trump and what really happened in those conversations and exchanges. And we don't really know how exactly Trump got elected and how much Russia did in the end. And we don't really know how much information Russia got from Trump, whether intentionally or because he's Trump, during interactions when Putin and him met. We don't really know. But what we do know is that he probably got enough for him to be very comfortable with not worrying about the United States for 4 years. And that's a simple answer for why. There was no reason to do that. Now, whenever he felt threatened, I'm going to go back to 2008 and the election of Obama. I'm going to go to 2012 and the re-election of Obama. Whenever he felt threatened, it provoked a military action. First it was Georgia, then it was Crimea and Ukraine. Now that Biden is elected and clearly is not on the same page as Putin, he feels more threatened. And also he feels like he now has a justification with an unfriendly leader of a nemesis state to act that in the way that would in fact position him favorably in Russia. And essentially, Biden has given him an opportunity to point fingers at the US and say, they're the enemy. The Russians were applauding and drinking to Trump winning the elections, and the US was not the enemy at that time. Certainly not in the propaganda machine that has been created by Kremlin over the last 20 years.
Okay, great. Would anyone like to ask a question in the audience?
I think we're all kind of recovering for a moment from what was said. I would like to know, I don't understand the relationship between China and Russia. Historically, they weren't close. If anything, they were rivals. So I don't understand why the sudden friendship.
Well, I'm not a China expert, so I couldn't speak for China for you. But I can tell you that, yes, what you said is true. At the same time, both of these are ascendant regional powers, both Russia and China. And yes, they compete. They compete with each other in certain areas, but at the same time, there's a lot of similarity between China and Russia. And what I mean by that is essentially in the kind of political system, just an overall appearance of the political system that exists with one leader at the top with a lot of power, able to make decisions on his own behalf and the behalf of those who are very close to him. So in that sense, we're talking about two dictatorships, I'll call it what it is. And it's convenient for them to ally with each other or create an alliance with each other when there is an enemy that is threatening one or the other. And obviously China is a really interesting situation, Evan, having become what it has become for the world and the United States, and the extent to which there's so much dependency between China and the United States, and which is more dependent on which is not going to be discussed here today by me. But China is, I'd say, in a very precarious position. And I believe that China would not want to experience the brunt of the kinds of sanctions that Russia has experienced in any way, nor would they be beneficial to the Western consumer and just in general the world. And so I think China may hold a key to de-escalation. But at the same time, China is on its own path, and messianism, I do believe, applies to China in Chinese culture and sort of their psyche or civilizational perspective on where they stand in the world now and historically. And in that sense, I think they would be willing to go further in supporting Putin and helping out by, I don't know, financing him, maybe buying his oil, maybe buying his minerals. I read an article in, I think it was The Economist, maybe a week ago, and it talked about how Russia is basically going to align its currency with Chinese renminbi, and it's not going to use the dollar any longer for measuring its own value. And if that's the case, that's only going to bring the two countries closer. I'm not sure if you know about this, but China and Russia have been working on an alternative to IMF for a really long time now. And they have this joint, I think it's called the Eurasian Bank for Development and Investment, or something along those lines. But they've been doing what IMF would be doing or is doing, except now representing the sort of values and overarching goals of these two countries together. And anyone that stands between Russia and China, so anyone north of India for that matter, so we're talking about Central Asia, parts of Southeast Asia, they're all within the fold of this potential, the influence of this potential financial institution. So there's a lot of projects that are ongoing between Russia and China. I'm not sure if you paid attention to it, but China and Russia had a series of military exercises in the Sea of Japan and just in general in the Pacific over the last several years. So they've been positioning themselves as partners, and China has been, with that, has been able to claim more territory in Southeast Asia, not just building things out of sand, which it is also doing, but also claiming maybe portions of territorial waters of some of the neighboring states. I believe it was Vietnam that claimed that China is now patrolling much closer to its coasts than it used to, claiming a portion of the territorial waters that used to belong to Vietnam as its own. But anyway, so if you're sitting here and you have no idea what I just said, I would say that two aggressive, ascendant, dictatorial systems, Russia and China, are pursuing their goals of growing their power and influence globally and asserting that globally, projecting that globally as much as possible. And in that, they can be cronies for some time until maybe their interests clash, truly clash. But until there is an external enemy that is big and threatening, by the way, democracy and democratic institutions are threatening to both, they're going to co-align and maintain some sort of civility, maybe even friendship in certain areas.
All right, great. So we have a question from the chat that involves a possible NATO no-fly zone. Mm-hmm. And again, at least my reading of this would be that could provoke a possible nuclear conflict. So again, what are some things that the US and other Western countries can do in the next few weeks? I mean, again, to perhaps try to bring the conflict to some kind of negotiated settlement, or, I mean, where do we go from here?
Yeah. So that's a great question. No-fly zone first. You're absolutely right. What this would mean is that NATO is going to be shooting down Russian planes over Ukraine. And that's equal to shooting at Russia, right? So that's why they've been resistant to it, because they don't want to be sucked into this conflict. So what can we do without directly confronting Russia in military action to try to sort of find a solution to this that is going to reduce human suffering, that is going to end destruction and murder of people? I mean, Europe is, I think, in its worst refugee crisis since World War II, with what, some 2.5 million people all of a sudden showing up on the borders of European states, and other states for that matter. People are traveling south to the Caucasus and also to Central Asia. So I guess one way to think about it would be to try to understand, and this is a proponent's cosmopolitanism speaking in me, try to understand Russia a little better. So that would be a starting point. Try to understand Ukraine a little better. That would also be a starting point, right? Understand the history of the two and understand some of the references that are made by Russia when it is doing certain things to Ukraine is very important, right? So why is there such currency and apparent legitimacy to Russia's claims in Russia directed at Russian population to Nazism in Ukraine? We need to understand that. Why is this happening? Right? And is there any validity to it? And if there is, how did they amplify that? And what are they doing to continue to amplify it? To understand how to confront that, we need to understand where it starts for them and what they're doing. And of course, the answer is simple. Well, it's all to maximize Putin's power. Yes, that's the answer to everything. But if we are to deconstruct it a little bit and try to understand it better, we need to start small. We need to understand that there are still channels of information that are disseminating it to Russia against the will of the Kremlin, that are telling the truth to the Russian people. In my opinion, we need to do everything in our power to support those channels. And at this point, I think we're looking at a very realistic possibility that internet and things like YouTube are now probably the only ways average Russians can access alternative information on a regular basis. So seek those bloggers out, support them, give them platforms, link their news stories, their information to more sources around the world that we can. Spread that word more and show that support so they continue doing what they're doing. Because even at the height of the Cold War, we had journalists from Washington Post, from New York Times, the ones that just split Bloomberg, Time Magazine, Life in Moscow reporting with direct access to press secretaries of the Communist Party or the Politburo. We had that. We don't anymore. Isn't that insane? So it's going to be total darkness if these last sources are going to be extinguished, and we cannot let that happen. So doing that is very important. If you're looking for references and the names of the people, I'll be happy to provide those with you to you, and you can go ahead and look and support, look for those bloggers and support them. I mean, that's something that we can do from our armchairs. But we can also do something much, much more drastic. We can go to Ukraine and fight the Russians. Now, as of yesterday, 17,000 foreign fighters, with I think a group of some thousand or more people from the US, went there, picked up guns, and are actually standing against the Russians. Now, this is something direct. This is something tangible. This is something we can do. And really, how much Russia will gain will depend on people like that, of course, the Ukrainians as well, and how far Russia will be able to go. And whether or not it is going to stop where it is now and not be able to advance. And therefore, Kyiv will maintain at least the control of Western Ukraine and will continue to be a democracy of some form, sort, or shape while being, of course, attacked constantly from the territories controlled by Russia, may depend on this. So we can't do that, of course. We do really need to also find ways, and this is now we're talking about hybrid warfare, of engaging Putin and trying to beat him at his own game. They've been doing this for a long time. And one of the reasons for why Russia has increasingly been more aggressive, more provocative, freer at doing what it wants to do is because we kind of just put it on the back burner and we stopped nitpicking it. We stopped worrying about what it's doing and we stopped paying attention to what its goals are and how it can behave. And I'm not sure if you've been paying attention to this or not, but over the last 3 or 4 years, Russia's air traffic has increased in where it flies its strategic nuclear bombers around the world on a regular basis. And it becomes essentially now a regular thing, right? So as we speak, there's probably somewhere a strategic nuclear bomber flying above our heads that is flying in the international airspace that is there should Putin decide to press that button. Russia's advances in this area and its behavior has only escalated. And we haven't really discussed it. We haven't really talked about it. No one is really worrying about it as much. There's a blip in the news here and there, but we're not making it as big a story as Ukraine is, and we really need to. We really need to talk about this more openly in multiple ways. And we need to understand that this can escalate and this can be really bad. We need to start taking things a bit more seriously than we are. And it's not just living from election to election, it's living every day, trying to increase our understanding and trying to alter our behavior so that we can account for all of this and not just be informed, but also take some sort of action on our end to try to, I don't want to use the word undermine, but try to slow Russia's, short of the word right now, but let's call it Russia's advance.
Alex, I have to take you up on that point that you mentioned about change our behavior, because I noticed a question in the chat, and I was hoping we could bring it up before we ended our conversation here, is about the continued existence, and I would add the word expansion of NATO. And I mean, NATO's whole purpose was there with the Soviet Union being around, but Soviet Union is no longer there. And there's a part of me that feels that, and I've talked about this in my classes, part of me that feels that there is a bit of blame that NATO also has to take, especially NATO's expansion, which has always been threatening for the last 30 years since the Cold War ended. And I don't think we can completely understand this issue without understanding the dangers that expansion has brought to a large extent. So I would like to hear your thoughts on that, but and I would also like to chime in if there's time left.
Yeah, I agree with you. I'll go farther than that. I will say that the way the US has conducted and increased its own hegemony over the last 50 years is one of the direct results, or I should say one of the direct reasons for the results that we're seeing now. We have to talk about US-American hegemony, and we have to really examine US-American behavior and the elements of that behavior that not just anger and not just inspire, but justify the actions of people like Putin. And if you're wondering, how does Putin think about the United States? Go no further than reading the introduction of the book by Paul Atwood called War and Empire. Famously, Stalin had Niccolo Machiavelli's Prince on his bedstand, right? Well, I think Putin got something that is similar to the kind of thinking, to the kind of critical perspective on the US-America, American history and on the US-American foreign policy that just even the intro for this book captures. And so read that and then go ahead and just for your own entertainment, if that word can be applied in reference to Putin and what he does and says, in my mind, it no longer does. I'm here in this discussion only because I think this is important. I want to throw up when I see his face for the last couple of years, but especially when I turn on a Russian news channel and I see or hear what he has to say, the way he has to say it. And it's just a separate topic for conversation. But if you want to read the 2015 United Nations speech that he gave, you will see after reading the introduction to Paul Atwood's piece that I would almost say sentences are lifted out of there and put into the speech. And this is 2015. This is following the invasion of Crimea, annexation of Crimea. But nevertheless, this is 7 years ago. 7 years ago, he talked about it. He's done it. He invaded Crimea. He's invaded Georgia. He's taken parts of the territory of that country and made it Russian, right? He's done all of this. It was all moving in this direction. It was getting increasingly more and more aggressive. It was apparent that it could lead to something worse. And yet, no action. And of course, it didn't help that we had soft gloves in the face of Mr. Orange in the office for 4 years, and that only untied Russia's hands further and also empowered further, because I don't know what kind of helpful or let's call it strategic information he was able to get out of that partnership and may still be getting. I know it's the end, Evan, so 2 minutes. I shared some sources for everyone there to have a look at in the chat if you want to take a look at it. I find them helpful. If you want to understand how Putin came to power and why, and the sort of continuum that Russia's government has been on, read the neo-KGB piece by The Economist from 2008. It's a really, really nice insight. Very clear. It makes things very clear. And I have been using this article in my courses ever since. And I will tell you that I have not come across a clearer piece on talking about what happened then and how Putin and the FSB group came to power. And that's something I want everyone to sort of keep in their mind. We're not dealing with traditional politicians here. We're dealing with people who were reared from the early age to kill, to protect their own interests, to protect the elites in power, and now they are the elites. So it's that much more important to them to do what they do best, and that is what Russia has been doing.
Okay, I'm gonna have a drink. I don't know about anybody else.
I wish I could have one with you, Evan.
Okay, I'd like to share. I wanna thank you so much, Alec, for an incredibly illuminating educational hour. And thank you so much for your time. And thank you so much for everyone who came. It's an incredible showing of people who are interested from all across our university. And I look forward to seeing you in person soon, Alec. Be well.
You're all very welcome. Thanks for coming and thanks for your comments in the chat. And if anybody wants to consider doing another hour on Putinism, we can do that as well, because we haven't talked about it. And that there is a real beast, and we should be really worried about it.
Thanks again.